case number 236416. Hold on a second, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Kason Ross for Lieutenant Dutton. The district court should have dismissed plaintiff's remaining claims against Lieutenant Dutton because he failed to state a claim against that officer. The Supreme Court has never recognized a Bivens remedy for an Eighth Amendment violation based on a prison official's alleged failure to protect an inmate from other inmates. While the court in Carlson v. Green inferred a Bivens claim based on a failure to provide adequate medical treatment in violation of the Eighth Amendment, it has never construed Carlson more broadly to encompass any Eighth Amendment violation. In Abbasi, Hernandez, and Egbert, the court has consistently described three cases as inferring Bivens remedies: Bivens itself, Carlson, and Davis. This court and the Supreme Court have consistently held that each of those three contexts are narrowly construed to exactly the circumstances presented in each of those cases. During the period when the court consistently declined to infer or recognize new Bivens remedies, it clarified the standard for deliberate indifference for purposes of violating the Eighth Amendment in Farmer v. Brennan. But in that case, it did not recognize a new Bivens remedy or a cause of action, which is a separate question from the merits of what constitutes deliberate indifference in violation of the Eighth Amendment. In clarifying that standard, the court never held that it should recognize a new Bivens remedy in that context, and the Fourth, Seventh, and Ninth Circuits have accordingly recognized that Farmer was not a Bivens case and did not recognize a new cause of action.
Counsel, if we agree with you that the district court erred in applying pre-Egbert law, mm-hmm. or relying on the Third Circuit case that was decided before Egbert v. Bowl or Bowell, mm-hmm. Supreme Court decision 2022, do we need to reach the second question? We don't need to reach the second question, do we, on qualified immunity?
No, you don't, Your Honor. And in fact, I will also note that the Third Circuit's decision in Bistrian predated Hernandez as well, the second Hernandez v. Mesa decision. And in that case, the Supreme Court explained that whether to infer a new Bivens remedy is in fact antecedent to the question of qualified immunity, and courts should answer that question.
What case is that?
Hernandez v. Mesa, Your Honor. That's the second Hernandez decision, I believe, in 2020. In that case, the Supreme Court explained that whether to recognize a new Bivens cause of action is antecedent to the question of qualified immunity. And in Egbert itself, the Supreme Court explained that waiver and forfeiture doctrines are a little loosey-goosey, shall we say, when it comes to determining whether to infer or recognize a new Bivens remedy, because the existence of a cause of action is an important question that should be resolved at the outset of litigation before determining questions of qualified immunity.
So in Hernandez, just let me make sure that I understand, was it discouraged or was it an instruction that that must be the order of analysis?
It wasn't an instruction that it must be, but I think it was encouragement that would be the most appropriate course. Because, to Judge Kahn's question, whether a cause of action exists in the first place is logically antecedent to an officer's entitlement to qualified immunity. So if a plaintiff has no cause of action, there's no question of whether the officer might be immune.
But that is true in almost all qualified immunity analysis. In other words, the issue is effectively whether a cause of action is clearly established. So whether there's a violation of law, and whether that's clearly established. And the violation of law component of that entails, in the minor of cases, whether there is a clear cause of action, right?
I don't think that's right, Your Honor, actually. For example, when a cause of action is brought under 42 U.S.C. 1983, that provides the cause of action. When a claim is brought under Bivens, the claim arises under the Constitution itself. So whether the claim itself exists is a different question from whether
That I understand, but mm-hmm. I think in many of the cases that are before us, it's not a question of, for example, whether there's a cause of action under whatever the civil rights statute is.
1983.
Whatever it is, just taking it across cases, but rather whether it was clearly established that the officer's conduct violated that statute.
So I think that's an important distinction. So here, there is no statute applying a cause or providing a cause of action. The cause of action arises under the Constitution itself,
The Bivens.
Correct. But and so the important question for this case is whether to recognize a cause of action in the circumstances presented here.
Are you saying that, and maybe this is since Hernandez, but even before Hernandez, are you suggesting that we have not analytically gone or grapple with qualified immunity when we have a Bivens action?
So the Walker cases that are cited in the party's briefs, the cause of action brought in Walker, which is cited in the party's briefs, was a Bivens action. But the court declined to address whether to recognize a Bivens cause of action, as in Farmer v. Brennan itself, in fact,
yes.
And instead considered the question of qualified immunity. Now that the court may determine that should be the appropriate course here, but the Supreme Court's instruction in Hernandez suggests that the court should, in the first instance,
consider those cases since Hernandez, before Hernandez.
That is a good question, and I'm not sure.
Because it's important to me.
Yes.
Because what you are pressing is a form of analysis that cuts across Bivens actions.
So the first Walker decision predated Hernandez, and the second postdates Hernandez. Regardless, I will just reiterate the Supreme Court's guidance in that case, and I think in Egbert as well, that whether a cause of action exists, I think, is a precedent to, or precedent to, whether an officer should be entitled to qualified immunity. In any event, I think that the Officer Dutton should have been entitled to qualified immunity in this case because he was not given clear instruction or put adequately on notice that his conduct, as alleged, would have violated any of plaintiff's clearly established constitutional rights. The relatively vague warnings that plaintiff provided to Lieutenant Dutton would not have given Lieutenant Dutton sufficient notice that he was going to, that the plaintiff would have been attacked, or that he needed to be put in protective custody for a particular reason. And I think in this respect, the court's Morgan decision is instructive. There, officers who were, the court held, were not entitled to qualified immunity, had very specific articulated threats that an inmate was facing harm from another prisoner for a particular reason. The plaintiff in that case identified particular pejoratives that another inmate had levied against him, as well as the specific kinds of harm that the other inmate had threatened him with, namely, I think, being stabbed. Here, plaintiff only suggested that he was in, quote, grave danger, but provided no specific articulated basis for that fear. And so Lieutenant Dutton, following the Bureau of Prisons policy, in fact, declined to put plaintiff in protective custody because there was not sufficient warning for those threats.
Are you aware of, since Egbert, are you aware of any federal court outside of the Third Circuit, with the exception of course the district court below and following the Third Circuit precedent, that has held that Farmer recognized the new Bivens action?
No, Your Honor. I mean, in fact, the Third Circuit, subsequent to the Bistrian decision in Mamana v. Barbin, has recognized the tension in its own case, the holding in Bistrian with Hernandez itself. In that case, it involved a conditions of confinement claim, and the court declined to recognize a Bivens remedy in that case. Now, I think applying the same logic from Bistrian, Farmer would also have recognized a conditions of confinement claim, but the Third Circuit in Mamana, albeit in an unpublished decision, held that it would not extend Farmer to reach that context. And I think that follows the trend in the courts of appeals, the Fourth, Seventh, and Ninth Circuits, that have declined to recognize those kinds of Bivens claims for an Eighth Amendment violation.
Can I ask you sort of an underlying question?
Mm-hmm.
So what more should Ballard have told Lieutenant Dutton about the risk to his safety?
I think he should have named the prisoner who had threatened him, Prisoner Chu, as he's identified in the complaint. Also the reason that plaintiff feared for his safety, as well as perhaps the kinds of threats that Chu had levied at him. None of that is alleged in the complaint, and I don't believe Lieutenant Dutton would have had any of that information. So a lot of the allegations that plaintiff presents as well are interactions that Mr. Ballard had with other officers at the facility, and plaintiff's interactions with Lieutenant Dutton himself were quite limited, and I believe he only interacted with him face-to-face once, and then there was a phone call during which plaintiff was speaking with another officer who then relayed concerns to Lieutenant Dutton.
You just responded that he failed to identify why he felt he was at risk or being threatened, but he did identify that, right? He said it had to do with the fact of the basis for his incarceration, the conviction being one of alleged sexual assault of minors,
mm-hmm.
and that he was supposed to get some paperwork to prove that it didn't involve minors, right? So the
right.
prison authorities knew that much, right?
Simply his, I think, generalized basis for fearing assault. And it is true that Mr. Ballard had been assaulted at a prior facility, but that information was not available to Lieutenant Dutton at the outset, and plaintiff did not articulate any additional reason why he would have feared being assaulted simply because he was a convicted sex offender. In Morgan, the inmate had warned officers that he even feared being attacked at a specific time during recreation time. And the court held that that would still not preclude the officers from being entitled to qualified immunity because they didn't have sufficient understanding or notice of the potential attack. I see I've gone far over my time, so I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Let me ask you a question to go back to the Farmer. So
mm-hmm.
can you just reconcile the judgment of Farmer to vacate the dismissal of the Eighth Amendment claim and remand for further proceedings with this argument that Farmer doesn't recognize a Bivens cause of action?
Mm-hmm. Of course. So I think there's two reasons, Your Honor. First, the petitioner in that case did not seek the Supreme Court's review based on the question of whether a Bivens remedy existed, nor did the federal respondents in that case argue that no such remedy would have been available. So because that issue was not presented to the court, it didn't rule on it. And as this court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly recognized, those kinds of questions merely lurking in the record should not be understood to actually resolve the question based on an assumption in the court's holding. Second, I think the court's treatment of First Amendment retaliation claims in Hartman v. Moore and subsequently in Egbert is instructive in this regard. Similarly, in Hartman, the Supreme Court assumed for purposes of argument that there would be a First Amendment retaliation claim arising under Bivens. That was a Bivens case. And in subsequently in Egbert, the Supreme Court held that there was no such claim, squarely rejecting that argument. But that does not call into question the substantive analysis of what constitutes a First Amendment retaliation claim, for example, under 1983, that the Supreme Court articulated in Hartman itself. So Hartman remains good law insofar as what constitutes a First Amendment retaliation claim, but that because that case never actually addressed what is whether a Bivens remedy would lie, the court or that decision should not be understood to be read as much. And the Seventh Circuit's decision in Sargent, I think, is quite helpful in this regard, because it there explained that because there's no Bivens holding in Farmer itself, there's the court's decisions declining to recognize a Bivens remedy for failure to protect claims would not overrule Hart Farmer in any respect, because that case didn't address that question.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You preserve some time for rebuttal. We'll hear from your friend on the other side. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Greg Tsui on behalf of Appellee Antonio Ballard. The district court should be affirmed because it followed what Farmer said and what Farmer did. Judge Loyer, as you said, the key to understanding Farmer is the judgment, is following what Farmer did. And what Farmer did was recognize that D. Farmer had invoked a cause of action under Bivens, and it sent that claim forward to discovery and eventually to trial. It wouldn't have done that if there was no cause of action in the first place. My friend on the other side told you today that the Bivens question is, quote unquote, antecedent to all other questions, to questions about the merits and questions about qualified immunity. He told you that even waiver and forfeiture are, quote unquote, loosey-goosey in the Bivens context, because again, Bivens is the first order question to answer when it comes to these sorts of causes of action. And he told you that it is important to address Bivens, quote, at the outset of litigation, to know whether there's a cause of action in the first place. That's what Farmer did. Farmer wouldn't have moved to the merits of the Eighth Amendment claim, ruled in the plaintiff's favor on those merits questions, and sent the case back for more discovery and eventually for trial if, at the outset, there was no cause of action in the first place. The district court followed Farmer by doing what Farmer did. It recognized that Mr. Ballard has brought the exact same kind of claim. And my friend on the other side doesn't contest that Mr. Ballard's claim is the same kind of Eighth Amendment failure to protect claim as the claim in Farmer.
Hasn't the Supreme Court in subsequent cases identified where it has recognized a Bivens claim? And it's never identified Farmer as recognizing a Bivens claim.
It has
Farmer. So what are we to do with that? The court that issued Farmer doesn't recognize it as a Bivens claim. So what is this court to make of that?
Well, to be clear, Your Honor, I don't agree that the court has said Farmer didn't recognize a Bivens claim.
The but court, hasn't the Supreme Court said we have only recognized a Bivens claim in three cases, in cited three cases, none of which were Farmer, correct?
Correct. And two responses on that, Your Honor. First of all, it did cite Carlson, and Carlson is part of the same recognized context for these sorts of claims. And so what you'd be doing is inferring that because the court didn't also cite Farmer alongside Carlson, that somehow precludes.
I understand that argument, but the facts in Farmer are far different from those in Carlson. In Carlson, it was an inmate died because the prison not only ignored his medical needs and would not provide treatment, in addition to that, administered treatment that actually induced his death. So that's a very different case than a failure to protect case. It was a failure to give dire medical attention. And every circuit that has looked at this issue has distinguished those two cases and has said that the Supreme Court has not recognized a Bivens claim in the Farmer case.
Well, I disagree with that, Your Honor, because Bistrian, the third circuit.
No, I know. I'm trying to understand why every other circuit that has looked at this has misunderstood.
I think it's because they've made the mistake of not recognizing that Farmer did recognize a Bivens context. And as a result, they were willing to treat something less than an express overruling of Farmer, which all of the decisions that my friend points to are. They are less than an express overruling of Farmer. They don't mention Farmer either way, and they certainly don't overrule that precedent such that courts of appeals don't need to follow it. So I think the other courts have made the mistake of refusing to recognize what Farmer did, and as a result, treating subsequent language as somehow undermining it. But what this court has said...
Oh, go ahead.
sorry, Your Honor. I was just going to say what this court has said in decisions like Parks is that circuit courts are to apply the law as it exists unless it is expressly overruled. So even if subsequent decisions use language that seems inconsistent with a prior precedent, if the prior precedent is on point, it controls. And this court is right to do that because in Agostini, the Supreme Court said exactly that, and it commended this court. Judge Sack, you said the Supreme Court doesn't often thank this court, but in Agostini, it did. It commended the Second Circuit and the District Court for following its prior precedents, even though later language seemed inconsistent with them, because this court respected the Supreme Court's right to overrule its own precedent and not to jump ahead and read the tea leaves and do so for the Supreme Court. So that's the same thing here, Your Honor. Again,
what is the prior precedent with respect to the failure to protect claims as a Bivens cause of action in our court?
In this court, it would be Walker. So in Walker, this court said in 2013 that, quote unquote, the district court had properly construed his claims pursuant to Bivens. And by claims, I'm referring to failure to protect claims at this exact facility, at FCI Raybrook. So Walker addresses truly this exact kind of claim, and again, sent that claim forward all the way to trial and all the way to verdict, a $20,000 verdict in the plaintiff's favor.
Was that as a Bivens claim?
It was as a Bivens claim, Your Honor. You recognize that the district court was right to construe it according to Bivens. Because again, it was against federal officials at FCI Raybrook, just like Mr. Ballard's claim is. This court wouldn't have sent that claim all the way to verdict if there was no cause of action in the first place. Because again, as my friend said, the Bivens question must be resolved at the outset of litigation. That's what Farmer did, and that's what this court did in 2013 in Walker, before it initiated a whole series of litigation founded on the premise that there was a cause of action in the first place.
Wasn't Walker a qualified immunity case?
So Walker, in 2022, following the jury's verdict, was resolved on the PLRA and qualified immunity, based on facts found by the jury. This court relied on the fact that the jury, in its special verdict form, said that there was no physical injury. And for that reason, based on that factual finding, this court applied the PLRA's physical injury requirement and qualified immunity. That information only came to light because of the jury trial that this court sent the case forward to. In 2013, this court had the opportunity to say, you know what, we don't need to have a trial at all because there's no cause of action in the first place. And this court said the opposite. This court said, again, the district court properly construed his claims pursuant to Bivens. That's at footnote 5 of the 2013 Walker decision.
I guess I'm still struggling why you're asking us to follow Walker in light of the Supreme Court decision in Abbasi and then repeated in Egbert. And I quote, Bivens, Davis, and Carlson represent the only instances. The court didn't say instances, the only instances in which the court has approved an implied damages remedy under the Constitution itself. So the Supreme Court has been very clear that those are the only three cases where they've recognized a Bivens claim. And so I'm struggling with your position advocating that we should follow Walker and what I view is sort of ignore this very clear direction of the Supreme Court.
No, Your Honor, I'm not asking you to ignore it. But what I am saying is that when you are faced with language that seems inconsistent with a prior precedent, the Supreme Court has told you how to handle that kind of conflict. In Agostini, it said subsequent Establishment Clause cases had suggested that the Supreme Court's jurisprudence had gone a different way from decisions like Ball and Aguilar. And Agostini said that what courts of appeals are to do in the face of that kind of conflict between an on-point precedent and subsequent language that seems inconsistent is apply the on-point precedent unless and until the Supreme Court itself overrules that on-point precedent. Farmer is that precedent here, Your Honor. And remember, Egbert, Hernandez, Ziegler, those cases have nothing to do with the Eighth Amendment or failure to protect. Egbert was about a Fourth Amendment claim and a Fifth Amendment claim concerning a bizarre cross-border smuggling scheme. Ziegler was about the government's response to 9/11, and Hernandez was about a cross-border shooting situation. My friend on the other side has told you repeatedly, the Bivens analysis is claim-specific. And if that's right, then the case...
But then in Ziegler, and I think if maybe perhaps all three of those cases, the Supreme Court has also instructed us that expanding expanding the Bivens remedy is disfavored, is strongly disfavored. But maybe I've misunderstood your precise argument.
No, I agree with that, Your Honor. But again, this is a step one question. We're not asking you to expand Bivens. We're asking you to apply Farmer, to recognize that this is the exact same claim that the court addressed in Farmer. It's also part of the same context that Carlson recognized.
You're not saying that it was a holding in Farmer. You're saying that it's impliedly recognized a Bivens remedy. Is that correct?
I think, Your Honor, again, the court did expressly recognize that Farmer invoked a cause of action.
What language? Just point me to the precise language.
Sure. It's at page 830 of Bivens and at page 839. And at those two pages, the court recognizes...
A Farmer,
exactly. That D. Farmer invoked a Bivens cause of action. 830, exactly. And 839. And I agree with you that the court didn't do a lengthy analysis of the Bivens question. And the court has never said that you only need to follow its precedents if it invokes the right magic words or gives you enough explanation to justify itself. I think the key is, again, what my friend has agreed to, that the court could not have gotten to the merits, ruled in the plaintiff's favor on the merits, and sent the case forward to discovery and trial if it hadn't.
Counsel, I'm looking at the Farmer decision,
and
at page 830, all it does is it's a factual recitation of what happened and that the defendant in that case brought a Bivens claim, but that's all it says. It doesn't say that we recognize a Bivens claim in the context.
No, I agree with you, Your Honor.
Okay, so where else in the Farmer opinion do you believe there's a holding that Bivens has been extended to this cause of action?
Well, again, so I would point you to page 839, that's a page, again, Your Honor, that I agree doesn't do in express terms
That was my question. Your contention is that it impliedly.
Yes, Your Honor.
You pushed back on that and suggested that it was a clear holding. What's the page in Farmer? Because I credit, when you tell me something, I credit it, but I also want to see it. And now you're telling us that, in fact, it's impliedly.
Well, Your Honor, I wanted to be clear that the court recognized that this was a Bivens cause of action. I apologize if I wasn't clear about what those pages said. They don't do the kind of Egbert analysis, but they recognize that this was a Bivens cause of action. And as this court knows—
I'm not accusing you. I'm just, I'm trying to understand.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
With precision. This is the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Precision and accuracy matters. So what is the exact language in Farmer that you're—
Just, again, recognizing that it was a Bivens cause of action, citing Bivens and Carlson at 830, and at 839, when discussing the substantive standard that should govern that kind of claim, again, pointing out that this is a Bivens claim, and that between the fact that Bivens and 1983 are both civil claims, that it didn't justify the government's argument about kind of a criminal mens rea. The point was just to say that the court knew this was a Bivens cause of action, and as this court knows, and as the Supreme Court instructed federal courts prior to Farmer, when you have a Bivens cause of action, the first thing you do is ask this question. This is what the court said in Chappell at page 298. Before a Bivens remedy may be fashioned, the court must take into account the kind of special factors and the analysis that will determine whether or not Bivens should be recognized in the first place. Chappell was decided before Farmer. This is what the court said in Meyer, a case decided a few months before Farmer. Our most recent decisions have responded cautiously to suggestions that Bivens remedies must be extended. That's at page 484. So again, this is not a question the Supreme Court would have missed. This isn't a question that Justice Thomas would have missed, and he concurred in Farmer. So I emphasize that Farmer was explicit about what kind of cause of action it was, because by doing that and by still sending that claim forward, Farmer told us what it was doing and what courts should do when pressed with this same question.
Let me ask you a separate set of questions. First, you heard my colloquy with your friend, Mr. Ross, about qualified immunity. Do you agree with him that the analytical order should be that we've got to grapple with the Bivens issue, regardless of qualified immunity issues?
I do think you need to grapple with the Bivens issue, whether you do it first or second.
We do it first or second. Usually when we deal with qualified immunity, we determine qualified immunity. That's the end of the story.
Well, I think qualified immunity is straightforward in this case, Your Honor. So if you want to get through it first, I think that makes a lot of sense because, again, we have multiple on-point precedents addressing this exact kind of situation, starting with Farmer. I mean, this case is actually easier than Farmer because if you'll recall in Farmer, all officials knew was the fact that Dee Farmer had been previously assaulted at prior facilities because of her transgender status and that she faced a risk of the same at the new facility. Dee Farmer never objected.
What did Lieutenant Dutton know about the threat to Ballard?
Beyond
the fact that Ballard was generally fearful for his safety?
A lot more, Your Honor, and I'll quote Defendant Dutton himself for the best evidence of what he knew. He admitted on August 29th, 2021, that he was, quote unquote, well aware of Mr. Ballard's past victimization and well aware of his vulnerability of being a victim of further assaults at this facility, at FCI Raybrook, for the same reason, because of his sex offender status. I think the reason Ballard admitted that, the reason he had that information, is because Defendant Dutton admitted that and knew he had that information, is because Mr. Ballard had given that information to every official he met at FCI Raybrook, starting with the first officer he met upon arrival, and that officer told him that he, quote unquote, would most likely be stabbed at FCI Raybrook because of his sex offender status.
What page was the August 29?
August 29, that meeting is described at paragraphs 23 and 24 mm-hmm. of the complaint. The officer admitting that Mr. Ballard most likely would be stabbed, that's at paragraph 1 of the complaint. At paragraph 12 of the complaint, Mr. Ballard sends an electronic message, a written message to the warden of the facility raising these concerns. And at paragraph 26 and 27, Defendant Dutton has one more opportunity to avert this harm because Mr. Ballard and his assailant, prisoner number one, go to a prison official and they tell that official that Mr. Ballard is going to be harmed if he remains in the compound. That official calls Defendant Dutton, and on the phone with that officer standing in front of Mr. Ballard, Dutton denies protection again. So this is exactly what Morgan said. This is a longstanding, well-documented, and expressly noted objectively serious risk of harm.
Is part of your argument that the district court did not err when it came to its decision on qualified immunity? Because at this stage, it requires factual determinations, a subjective determination of what the officers knew and what the standard is to be applied to that.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. The district court applied qualified immunity on the facts of the pleading, and that could be different than the facts shown at summary judgment or trial. But at this stage, taking all the allegations in the light most favorable to us, the law was clearly established. This looks easier than Farmer. It looks exactly like Lewis decided in 2019 and Morgan decided in 2020, both before the incidents in this case. So that's why I said, Judge Loyer, that if you want to reach qualified immunity first, you can, because I think qualified immunity is straightforward. If there are no further questions, I just wanted to close by emphasizing again that Farmer and Carlson are the cases the Supreme Court has given us addressing this kind of claim. My friend on the other side relies on decisions like Egbert, and there was a decision post-Egbert, Your Honor, that reaffirms the Bistrian decision. The Third Circuit in Shee versus Hogan recognizes what Egbert told courts of appeals, that they shouldn't extend Bivens further, and it cited Bistrian as an example of the court not doing that, as an example of the court being respectful of the Supreme Court's guidance. And that's because Bistrian wasn't an extension. Farmer recognized this context. And when you have decisions that actually address the claim before you, you follow them. And
you
following
want us to follow the district court and apply only Third Circuit precedent as well.
No, I
get that.
No, Your Honor. I would just say that multiple courts have recognized what we're saying, which is that following Farmer means doing what Farmer did.
Well, multiple courts? You mean the Third Circuit. Every other circuit has gone the other
way. And the district court is the only other court I meant. That's right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it might be helpful to maybe zoom out a little bit about the timeline of all of these cases. So Farmer was decided in 1994, which predated, I think, what all recognize is the Supreme Court's new mode of analysis for Bivens claims in Abbasi. So there, the court clearly articulated a two-step framework in 2017 on how to determine when to recognize a new Bivens claim. And this court in Arar v. Ashcroft en banc and Doe v. Hagenbach said explicitly that the court has only extended Bivens twice since deciding Bivens itself in Davis and in Carlson. And at no point since the Supreme Court's decision in Carlson in 1980 had the Supreme Court recognized any new Bivens remedy. That would include the time when Farmer was decided in 1994. And it, as Judge Kahn identified, in Abbasi and then subsequently in Egbert, the Supreme Court has made explicitly clear that the only instances in which the court has recognized a new Bivens remedy was in Bivens itself, Davis, and Carlson. And the Supreme Court in Hernandez emphasized that even when a claim concerns the same constitutional provision, there may be a new Bivens context because different kinds of substantive standards apply. That is abundantly true with respect to failure to provide adequate medical care for a Carlson claim versus a failure to protect inmates from other harms in a prison facility, either from other officers or from other inmates. Those are different kinds of substantive standards and involve different merits questions. That means a new Bivens context arises here, as the Fourth, Seventh, and Ninth Circuits have cleanly recognized. The counsel on the other side cites She v. Haugen as apparently endorsing the reasoning in Bistrian, but that's because Bistrian declined to recognize a First Amendment retaliation claim. The court in She, the Third Circuit in She, did not opine on Bistrian's apparent recognition of a Bivens claim with respect to a failure to protect inmates under the Eighth Amendment. Rather, it was recognizing the Third Circuit's decision in Bistrian declining to recognize a First Amendment claim, which the Supreme Court subsequently agreed with in Egbert. Just turning quickly to the fact that the district court declined to dismiss the complaint based on the allegations, these are the kinds of questions that, taking the allegations as true, it's not a question of whether additional factual development is required, but rather simply looking at the face of the complaint and liberally construing it because it's a pro se plaintiff, whether those allegations state a violation of clearly established constitutional rights. The Supreme Court in Mitchell v. Forsyth and Behrens v. Peltier has made clear that the entitlement to qualified immunity should be determined at the earliest possible juncture to avoid the burdens of discovery and additional litigation. That's the whole point of qualified immunity in the first place. Absent any additional questions, we urge the court to both recognize the magistrate judge's thoughtful reasoning in this case and reverse the district court's order.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well argued on both sides. We will reserve the decision.